the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto-related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
Your passport determines how much you pay to move money internationally. When you send money from South Africa to Nigeria or Zimbabwe, your funds are routed through a multitude of different intermediaries, and they all take a cut. This can come to 20% or more, though the World Bank says the average for cross-border remittances is 7%. Well, the World Bank target is to get the costs of remittances down to 3%, but they have missed this target for more than a decade. Is there a better way? Well, certainly there is, and stablecoins point the way. Joining us to discuss this is Anton Titov, serial entrepreneur and founder of a company called Remedy, which has the purpose of improving how money moves across the globe. And that's the topic we're going to discuss today. Hi, Anton. Thanks very much for your time and good to talk to you. Tell us, why are we paying so much and so many different amounts when we transmit money internationally? I gave the example of South Africans sending money to Nigeria or Zimbabwe. But if you're in Europe, you're paying a hell of a lot less for moving money. Why is this?
Hi. Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure definitely to be here. So first of all, sometimes I'm paying nothing when I'm moving money across the Europe, UK or US. Reason behind that all of those financial systems have a super different structures and different operational modes across different countries and across different regions. When we're talking about Europe, there is a huge political will to have those money moving across different countries within Europe in a super efficient way. That's why there is SEPA, which system that allows to all banks be interconnected and send money real, like for the fraction of cents. Then there is different startups like Revolut or Wise, about which you may also hear, and they also uniting people across the Europe into one network where the money transmission costs zero. But as soon as we're going outside of those borders, this is where we're hitting a lot of different barriers. And one example could be ambition to move money from Europe in Czech Republic, for example, where I'm based, to South Africa or Nigeria. And this is where problems starts to appear. Those remittance fees might reach out around like 9% at least, and really sometimes it could be like more, depending like what is the purpose of the payment, what is the size of the payment, what is the risk of the payment. All of this always determines what's going to be the final costs. But one of the different problems with that is that those money are routed through many, many intermediaries. You maybe heard about like the SWIFT global payment system uniting a lot of the banks, more than 10,000 banks across the whole globe. But money not always routed through SWIFT, or sometimes they route it through SWIFT only from one bank to another intermediary, and then another intermediary is connected to a different payment system trying to deliver those money somewhere in the Africa. And problem is that all of those intermediaries cutting their piece of the money to justify their business models. And one of the problems could be even like for the Nigerian mobile money institution is that they're charging you 7% and you're thinking it's freakingly a lot. But problem is that not all of those money going into their pockets. They might leave on the table more than 5%, giving it to other intermediaries, and their revenues is only around 1%. So it becomes super expensive also for them. Literally, we need then to say that the whole system is inefficient for the final consumers and for the financial institutions also. And right now, before stablecoins appeared on the market, there were no better way how we can move money more efficient way. It's really like that.
All right. So, I mean, SWIFT we're familiar with in South Africa. Normally when you do a transaction cross border, they're going to charge you 500 Rand up to 1,000 Rand, depending on the size of the transaction. And you cannot escape that. So everybody who's ever done an international transaction understands the SWIFT aspect of it. But now it's an expensive system. And we're really here talking about an electronic transfer that seems to be completely automated, or it should be automated. Why are we still paying such high SWIFT fees?
Everyone wants to earn money. SWIFT is earning 35 billions per year, and I doubt they would ever will try to sacrifice on those money, because it's revenues for everyone. And before the disruption with stablecoins will really start to flood the world, this will stay like that, because nothing could move such a huge piece of technology and agreements and compliance that have been already established between thousands and thousands of financial institutions. It's really a hard thing to disrupt. And it's very interesting what happened due to Web3 money flows that has appeared within the last 10 years. This is not purposed by those financial institutions. It came out from rebels who wanted to disrupt all of that. And because regulation had a delay in terms of trying like to manage those money flows, no one were believing in that truly. It had a chance to become big enough, so everyone started to respect that. And now everyone thinks, okay, stablecoins is definitely going to stay with us. What are we going to do with that?
So you even see Swift coins, is trying to... stablecoins as a threat to this established system, this 35 billion euro or dollar system that is trying to hang on to its profits.
Yes, definitely. And what's important that Swift is not the only payment system that exists globally, right? There is much more which connecting all of those intermediaries. We can name different ones and they all earning their portion of the fees. And again, because of those inefficiencies and amount and how heavy is liquidity being moved, we have such prices. But stablecoins gonna get it down, but only after they've been adapted in a proper way. Because there is also a lot of problems with stablecoins by itself.
Talk about some of those problems with stablecoins and the fact that it's going to challenge this existing system, but only if it overcomes whatever difficulties or friction that it introduces to the system.
So then probably what you might see that already global statistics says that this year there are going to be more than 45 trillions moved in stablecoins. Where it's fair to say that 90% of those money belongs to the trading. Because stablecoin is usually a trading pair for the Bitcoin, Ethereum, etc., etc. And only a fraction of those volumes is devoted to the payments. But it's definitely going to be more, more, and more. And right now we have around 200 million users globally of the stablecoins. Till 2023, it's going to be 1.2 billion users of stablecoins. And 80% of those users will come from emerging markets. It says something. Stablecoins are not so much required for the well-established and efficient financial ecosystems like Europe, within the US, and probably developed markets, but it definitely have a lot of purpose to being used in emerging markets. And one of the problems that been preventing the adoption was regulation. And 2025, I think, has changed everything. This is really like the breakthrough moment. When MiCA, European regulation for cryptocurrencies, came in, been enforced, then Stablecoin Genius Act in US was published in June or July, where Trump basically signed that and told, hey, right now, if stablecoins are backed, this is a very valid way to be paid. That's almost equal to money. And all the banks got the green light. Okay, we need to do something with that. So regulation was one of the big, big pieces that was preventing that. Right now we have a regulation. Also, there is another additional piece of regulation that is very important to mention. Is called travel rule. Because FATF, Financial Force...
Financial Action Task Force, yeah.
Came 5 years ago, again, along with the trials of like MiCA regulation in Europe, and just told, we need de-anonymize Web3 transactions. One of the biggest problems they've been to use like for the fraud, for the anonymous transactions, for the black market transactions, etc., etc. But if we're really desiring to use the efficiency of the blockchain, have the speed and cost efficiency, we need to de-anonymize those transactions. And it can bring unity and it can bring fusion with the traditional finances. So this is the only way to have it really like regulated, compliant, transparent, traceable, etc. So for Web3 geeks who were really like saying, hey, Web3 gonna be fully independent into our control, not depending on anything, etc., etc., we will own our money. This is not the future. Financial systems will adapt stablecoins and efficiency of the blockchain, but it will be under the rules that have been there already for the 50 years at least, maybe even more. And then blockchain have different other problems that you might like to mention that we can also discuss.
All right. Now, the question that I have flowing from all of that is, if we start to see much more stable, aggressive stablecoin adoption, are we going to see these fees, these sort of 9% fees that Africans are paying, come down? And the travel rule, that does seem to trash this whole idea, this dream that the early adopters of crypto had, that we will own our own money, we will be self-sovereign, and nobody will know how we're transacting. That's presumably, that's gone. It's out the window.
Yes, it is. But even like one of your podcasts was about the SWIFT threat for South Africa, right? And it's managed in Washington and Brussels. And if they will decide to turn it off the same way as they did it like in 2022 for Russia, after war has started, it's all possible. So sanctions are not going anywhere. And there is still going to be like control on the global level and on the country level or financial institution level. So stablecoins adoption will happen, and it will be still probably under control and political influence. It's kind of like inevitable. This control might be more distributed because all countries will start to decide, because what's happening, like difference between SWIFT and current stablecoin connections of the financial institutions, that those connections between one bank in UK and another fintech in Africa could be established independently. It means they have a separate agreements, they have separate compliance flows saying, hey, we're okay to work under those conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And before there is no global sanctions, they're okay to work under those conditions. And those relationships being managed almost individually. SWIFT is something like globalizing the whole management of those relationships, establishing kill switches on the corridors per country, per financial institutions, per certain type of users on the global level. But I also think that SWIFT, one of the main innovations that SWIFT has brought 50 years ago to the market, is that it united all financial institutions in the network. And networks much more efficient than building individual bilateral connections. This is what is happening right now in stablecoin world. If I want, as a European fintech, be connected to Nigerian fintech or South African fintech, I'm coming after them. I'm doing know your business onboarding procedure. I'm trying to be verified and legit for them. I'm paying them monthly fees for supporting my cooperation with them. I'm paying them individual fees. I'm building with them API integrations, basically connecting our technology between each other. And I need to do it like per each corridor. So if I am, as a European fintech, want to do it like 10 times and open 10 corridors, I need to do it 10 times. It's huge overhead. And heavy to do and takes a lot of time. It's super expensive. Alternative to that, networks means you get connected to the network, you get access to all financial institutions. And SWIFT is efficiently network for financial institution. So before SWIFT in 2000, in 1970s, to connect 10 banks, to make them interconnected to each other, they need to build 45 integrations to each other, or 45 connections. Well, network always means only one connection to the network. Well, you have a global access to everyone. And that's where the next innovation step will happen in SWIFT. And it will also bring a lot of additional solutions for the problems that we had. One of which we've been mentioning between each of us is like that on the blockchain, if you send me money to the wrong Web3 address and it's not hosted by financial institutions, it's just like self-hosted wallet, and you do the mistypo, like 0 and O, which is very easy to do. I've did it on my own. I've lost my money. I dislike that. You really lose your money. You can do anything about that. Blockchain is irreversible. And a lot of financial institutions like board directors or founders with whom I'm talking, they're all complaining about that. It's a huge problem. If we really miss the target with 10 millions, it's a huge loss. We dislike that about the blockchain, but it's the nature of that. But if all wallets are managed under financial institutions, it means that there is a possibility to make a recall. Just coming to them and saying, hey, guys, we've just sent to the wrong address. Please refund us back. Or it was a fraudulent transaction. Please do something with those money. So basically, more traditional financial management, operational management comes into the play and allows to operate efficiently while preserving the speed and costs of blockchain. And this is what everyone wants. Okay, and I think this is the most crucial part of that.
Just pause on that. This is interesting. So this is a huge problem. And I cannot tell you the number of emails that we've received here at MoneyWeb from people who have sent crypto to the wrong address. And the thing that we've been explaining to them is,
sorry, you're done.
You're done. The money is lost. So what you're saying is that there is a way, or you've developed a technology, a SWIFT system, if you like, for the crypto age. Is that correct? Where the funds that are sent to the wrong address can be recalled. Is that correct? And how does that work?
Yes, it's correct. Basically, when we started to think about like Remedy, within this year, we've just seen how inefficient all the connections between financial institutions and stablecoins right now are, and how to resolve that. And we've just seen, okay, we're not the first one who is engaging with this problem. It literally was resolved by SWIFT 50 years ago. And with SWIFT, everyone was happy for the last 50 years before blockchain and stablecoins has appeared and everyone started to complain. Oh, SWIFT is too long. Oh, SWIFT is too expensive and such things, because they've seen that it's really have a capability to move money with cents, costs, and a fraction of seconds as a speed. But what are the problems of the SWIFT and what is the problem of the blockchain? Blockchain first, we have those Web3 addresses. They are very cumbersome and difficult. They've been built for the machines, for the protocols, for the smart contracts, not for the people. And we as a people very barred even in terms of like being capable to remember our ABAN and big for our bank, right? Not saying like Web3 wallet. And what we're bringing first as a first part of this innovation is global address book with the nicknames. So instead of wallets, we bring the abstraction and saying, okay, it's just enough to know your name and surname, nickname like on the Instagram or Telegram if you wish. And for me, sending money becomes as easy as sending the message on the WhatsApp. And second thing is, because we're building the network where financial institutions can join only, no anonymous wallets, it means that all of those banks that are starting to launch their stablecoin accounts, they manage those stablecoin accounts along with their traditional financial accounts in, running in fiat, in rand, in naira, in whatever. And then it means that there is always kind of a support line where you can just come and say, hey guys, it's been a fraudulent transaction, it's been a mistake, please refund. It means what we're trying to do, we're trying to abstract all the challenges of the blockchain itself that users been fighting with and why there were no big global adoption actually, and trying to solve that with the traditional systems, best practices that been already established that are like most innovative approaches in the fintechs that all being combined right now.
All right. I mean, one of the threats that has been, you mentioned it earlier, was that South Africa might be cut off from SWIFT. You know, that seemed quite shocking to a lot of South Africans. It does look like perhaps a remote possibility, but the Reserve Bank in South Africa has not dismissed it entirely. It does say it's remote, but we cannot dismiss it. If you have a SWIFT system for stable coins, as you've just mentioned, can countries still block payments?
As I told you before, probably like this global sanction or like sanction as in sanctions as an instrument to influence geopolitics wouldn't disappear, never. Because at the end, whatever financial infrastructure you're building in a regulated country like US or Europe, there is always a government that can come to you and say, we don't like those guys, and you will do something about that. Otherwise, we will just get rid of your license and you lose everything. So business always comes first. Whoever's doing that, even if it is like a consortium of the banks or if it is individual technology, probably it's inevitable. But what stablecoins brings right now, I think, is a time and possibility for the next 10 years if countries will start to adapt stablecoin regulations quicker than they do it now. So, for example, Kenya was super efficient in that. They brought the regulation within 6 months or 9 months of the whole work from zero to launch an official establishment of that. And I think each African country can repeat that and can start to adapt those stablecoin rails. Definitely country can protect certain corridors and can protect certain relationships. Because I think even what happened like with Russia, despite the fact that they've been cut it out like from SWIFT, they found different ways and different payment systems that are working outside of those controls that are still working for them. I don't have an opinion if it is like good or bad, but in general, like all of those sanctions, they're trying to change something within the country. It's just a question if it is a fair way, bad way, who is also get influenced, because I think that a lot of like fair citizens struggling from that, not only those people who's been targeted by such decisions. So stablecoins within the next 5-10 years will give an opportunity to preserve some financial flows, even in those high-risk bad scenarios. But it definitely doesn't mean that in 20 years, when things get settled, it would be different than how things working right now in SWIFT. Probably I'm like too pessimistic in that, but I really don't believe that this thing where you're like just being punk in finances, it won't go through. You either got connected globally and then you're playing global rules and you're being a good player, or you're becoming a bad player and you get excluded from the game. And I would say it's still quite fair.
It does raise the question, who actually controls SWIFT then? And because if the United States has a dispute with Russia or with Iran, do they have the power to cut these countries off from the international payment system? And is that fair?
Then we're getting to the super deep topic by itself, but SWIFT is controlled in Brussels and Washington. And we see that two major economic forces, United States and European Union, they're influencing a lot of trades. They're influencing a lot of import and export. And this is where economy is gaining a significant amount of money. So they are trying to push on those gears, asking, do they have a right or not? It's their choice, buy or not buy like oil or gas from certain countries if they dislike the behavior, right? They're not trying like to, they're not invading those countries. They're not trying like to change the government directly. They're just saying, sorry, but like, your way of doing things is just not fit with our way of doing things. That's why we don't like to buy this. It's like the same actually as imagine just corporate company saying that our new social responsibility politics is to be fully green. So we don't buy dirty energy, only green one. Are they bad actors or good actors in that case that they don't want to buy oil energy and they decide to buy wind energy? They just made a decision. We would like to be greener. We would like to be better. You're with us or not with us.
Okay, final question, Anton. Remedy. Let's just talk about Remedy. That's spelled R-E-M-I-D-E. What is that? We've kind of introduced it. It's a SWIFT system for the crypto age. But how is it going to change things? And what's the buy-in from banks?
Yeah. Basically, as I was mentioning before, current way of doing, I think we're right now in this pre-SWIFT moment for stablecoins, when all financial institutions building their integrations directly to each other. This is the most inefficient way how you can do things. I've been founder of the similar company establishing with the same problems, and my roadmap was packed with API implementations to other partners. So me literally as a founder, instead of building like best interface, best local fintech, more solutions, more services for my local users, I was trying to build my corridors. And this is like nonsense. If you're thinking like where I'm wasting my time and if it is useful approach of using my time and the whole team and all the money and investments on not. And it was definitely not the way. So this is why Remedy has appeared. And we're told, okay, we'll try just unite everyone in this ecosystem, all the blockchains, all the stablecoin issuers, all the financial institutions, and we will give rails that unite and also brings compliance on board. So it's respects the MiCA regulation, the Genius Act, the travel rule. It allows to connect USDC and USDT on different chains. It allows to check the policies, because what's important that, for example, in the SWIFT, if I will send even to your South African account from my Indonesian account $5,000, your bank will probably come to you and saying, hey, who is Anton? What type of business do you have with them? Can you prove that you're like the good actors right now? You will try to put the papers together, give it to them. You're waiting 7 days, then they reject the transaction, then they send it back. 1 month, we sit in both without money. And it could be preserved if there would be like a policy check, basically saying, hey, your bank is okay to get from my Indonesian bank only $1,000 per day, not more. And then it would go through without any problems, without raising any flags. So this is like pre-policy flights. What in general, like, Remedy is like four engines or four rails. It's like Global Address Book with those nicknames instead of the Web3 wallets. That's why it's less options to do a mistypo in the Web3 wallet. I just know your nickname. I see you in which financial institution I have found you, and I can send money to you. Second layer is this policy engine, which is checking like if we're eligible to exchange such amount of money between our corridors and financial institutions before money will be delivered somewhere. So we don't lose time if it wouldn't pass. Third thing is this travel rule engine, which basically collects your KYC, know your customer, or your personal identificational data in from your fintech and my fintech and exchange it between them. Because they're not directly connected, Remedy as a network resolved that. So it means that even if the transaction happens on the Web3 blockchain, Web3 address, it becomes de-anonymized. Both financial institutions start to understand who's current and who is Anton. And fourth engine is basically how to connect different liquidity, because we see that in Africa, USDT on Tron is the most adapted stablecoin. The same situation is Latin America. But in US and in Europe, especially because USDT doesn't have a MiCA license, only USDC is flourishing.
A MiCA license.
So even from that perspective,
for Europe, right?
MiCA license for Europe, yes, yeah. Absolutely. So basically all the financial institutions using USDC in Europe, and if everyone in Africa using USDT, it's like having a different phone lines. You never can call to each other. And we're connecting all of that. It means that you start to call, you want to decide where you want to call, you can get an answer if you're eligible to call to this person or get an reply answer from that person because policy will be checked. You could get individual information and you can make this call because we'll connect different liquidities. It's pretty similar to how correspondent banking works. If you're sending money from US to Japan, there will be a bank in Singapore that will connect this different liquidity. In a nutshell, this is what Remedy brings in. It brings the efficiency of cross-border operations, cross-financial institutions operations.
It certainly is a fascinating time that we're in. As you say, we're in the pre-Swift age for the stablecoin era or for the digital era. And I think we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Anton, for joining us and going through this and explaining some of the real choke points or friction points that exist in the current system and how you're going about solving them. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Karan. Pleasure to be there.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.